to the North Group. Security refined by intelligence. We're here to spotlight the best practices in critical safety and security issues in today's world and provide actionable strategies that you can implement into your day-to-day operations. From the individual to organizational level, our goal is to improve your risk management and response capabilities. Thanks for spending time with us today, and here's your host.
Hey, Rob, give us our starting topic.
What do you got, Dan?
Well, you guys may have to indulge me because as a behavioralist, I try not to miss a good evaluation on a good crisis. So my question to pose this morning is for each of us. What's the most prevalent change that we've seen in our immediate area with the coronavirus?
I knew I had to write that down. I grabbed my pen for it.
Excellent work. Because I got follow-on questions. I'm going to pick the brain trust here until you're dry.
I'll go first.
Do it.
So I would say, and this is Steve, I would say in my opinion, it's been the ability to understand the threat landscape, right? Because everything has been evolving. And there's so much uncertainty. And I don't think even from deployment to working in this industry, traveling around the world, doing all the security stuff, like I don't think I've ever been so uncertain of what the future holds. And that's been a change. Because usually we can shoot an azimuth and say, hey, we're going to walk this way. We're going to go this way. But I feel like somebody just took our compass and our protractor. It's like, no, you're not using that.
Well, but you know, I think that's what makes us good, I guess, kind of military people or crisis intervention folks, is before we pick up that compass, we're doing research. Something is taking us to that place. And that information aspect of it helps me to kind of guide my answer to that question. I don't know if that helps or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so I think about in a professional environment like you're talking about, Steve, where we are uncertain, you know, all these things are happening. We don't know what's going to come up. And again, you guys have heard me say this 1,000 times before. I'm an intel cycle guy. So we plan before we collect, before we move, you know, kind of thing. So on an individual basis in our private lives, how are we planning to collect, to move? If that's not too cerebral for you at 10 a.m.
Chris is harvesting chickens.
Yeah, no, I go quite above and beyond. I mean, but to answer your first question too, I mean, I've saved a ton of money on car insurance and gas money this last month and a half.
There you go. You know,
like not having to go to work, I could just work from here, has been great for my mileage and gas tank. But I've noticed definitely like a temperamental landscape change within the general populace via either social media posts or common interactions. And you definitely see the people that either there's definitely a clear right or left. You have the people taking this seriously and they're just no problem staying at home and living their life and just kind of going with the flow. They're disgruntled about it, but they still understand like that's what needs to happen. And over here you have the people that are like, that's fine, but the community and the country and the state and the corporations still need to roll, because at the end of the day, everybody has bills to pay from the bottom all the way to the top. You know, even the US, we still have bills to pay. I'm hoping China erases that after this whole situation happened, but you know, I'm not holding them to any promises there. So I've definitely seen that. I mean, personally, I mean, I've always lived a lifestyle where I can rely on myself as much as possible. Nothing's changed for me in that aspect. If anything, I've tried to fast forward it a little bit, but you know, everything costs money, so I can only go with what my expenses can afford.
And I think that's a great point, Chris, because I think we as kind of military studs in our environment of crisis, I think we have a very different perspective about how we live and how we die. And for a civilian, I think that is probably not to that point yet of great thought. I think we've had time to sit on a mountaintop in Afghanistan or in a wadi in Iraq somewhere and go, you know what, if it happens today, it happens today. And I don't think there's a lot of folks out there up to this point in time have had a chance to do critical thinking like that. So that's a good point, Chris. Anybody else have any thoughts?
Yeah, actually, I do. Thinking from the preparedness role, no one's really preparing anymore. Everybody's responding. So it kind of shut down my lane, at least for now. Obviously, no training, no exercises, things like that. I do like Chris's point about saving gas, but I'm almost at the point where I like driving around just so I can buy gas right now because it's $1.07 a gallon. But that really just shifted my lane more into the support role as opposed to the response role.
Yeah, and fortunately for us, that's your bread and butter. So it's good perspective to have. And it's nice that I think so far a lot of the webinars we've had and a lot of the podcasts have kind of reflected or at least given a lot of food for thought to those who haven't done a lot of that critical thinking yet. That's good.
I'm going to caveat with Rob on that because it's interesting as I talk to people that live in our community. In my opinion, for us, I live in a predominantly military or veteran community. So I'm sort of lucky to have the people that I have surrounding me and seeing the way people are acting and interacting with one another. There's just a huge respect level. Everybody is really focused on helping one another. And I think when you get into the communities that don't have people that have experience in dealing with situations that put you in an exigent circumstance, I think what ends up happening is you have panickers and people keep resorting to social media to try to figure out what is going on, how do we react, what do we need to do. And there's not a lot of true information being pushed. Supply chain issues, purchasing food, water, stockpiling freezer goods, and just preparing themselves for what if they can't get to Walmart. I don't see the supply chain slowing down too harshly. What I do see, though, is a person walking into Walmart and seeing 60 people in line and not wanting to wait that day, but they still need, you know, products or food to deal with. So I think that is where we just need to look at the preparedness side, like Rob was talking about. We can't really prepare right now. We're reacting. But while we're reacting, what can we do to better our situation for family? And ultimately, with you and your neighbor, you can help each other out.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, this Brig, I've got a question. So along the lines of what Nick is talking about, do you guys feel like your immediate community is coming together, or are they kind of going into isolation more, you know, with their families? What are you seeing along that spectrum?
This is Chris. You know, out here in my community, I've noticed people are coming together, still maintaining, you know, somewhat of social distancing, but they're making sure everyone's checking in on each other. We have some group community applications, and granted, my community is out in the sticks, but it's still broadcast pretty well. And everybody's, hey, does anybody need any paper products? How's everyone doing on groceries, this and that? Are there any elders in your area that need attention? You know, my grandmother lives 10 minutes down the road from me. I check on her every other day. And she's just the cutest little 5-foot thing you ever seen. And she's just, hey, my dishwasher broke. Can you come fix it? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. You know, so, I've seen situations like that, but also within this community, it's a farming community. Across the street, I have a 600-acre, lamb farm. They're all right now because of the second and third order effects with the supply chain issue that we've noticed, because America itself can feed itself very, very well. I'm not saying the quality of food's all there, but the amount of food, the sheer amount of food is absolutely insane. The problem is with this pandemic is you started seeing the limitations on things that have not been limited before. And now there's actually, it's caused a backup from bread to milk, to produce, to meat. Right now out west, you can get a feeder pig for $30 or free, and they're giving the whole lot of them out. Here in Michigan, it's hit a little bit more down to even like the small ag farm situations, not even like the massive pork farms or the massive beef farms, but the prices are getting driven down so low because they can't afford to keep them any longer without taking them to the butcher or selling them off for profit. They're completely flipped upside down. You have full semi trucks of milk getting completely dumped out because there's a 1 gallon per household limit per shopping time. So those are the second and third order effects that I'm seeing out here right now and hearing about within the local community.
Yeah, this is Steve. I'll say that, you know, it's I feel like it's day 727 of, you know, Monday. it's every day it feels like the same thing. But I mean, in our world, you know, we're still kicking and we're still running, but you know, you drive through my neighborhood and it's, you know, there's just this level of uncertainty. I mean, you walk through the grocery store and people are just, you know, now we've created this, this social distancing, you know, like, don't even look at me. Like, we've completely lost our minds. And you go to the grocery store, and if you don't know people, if you don't know somebody, I mean, they don't even want to look at you. Like, everybody's like eyes front, you know. It's weird. I think it's weird. I think that I think the emotional effects, like Dan's talked about from the start of this, I think those emotional effects are going to stick with us after we get the all clear, right? I think there's going to be this desensitization to human-to-human contact. It's just my thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's very regional, and I think it's very cultural. So just having moved around a lot, you know, and I remember when we moved to Tampa, and I went jogging for the first time along some trail, and all along the way, everyone waves at you and says hi. And it was very odd to me. It was like, why are these people saying hi? You know, we're just running by each other. And people were very respectful in driving. You know, people weren't tailgating you and things like that. And then I remember when we lived in Virginia, we went to a barbecue, and I noticed that all the kids called all the adults sir and ma'am, which was very respectful, and I wasn't used to that. I had to teach my kids that. But I think it's very regional as far as how we're helping each other out or how we're distancing. I mean, I think, you know, for our group, our guys, like, this is kind of status quo. Like, this is what we've been doing. Everybody I've talked to says, hey, this is a lot like deployment. You go somewhere, you know, you're kind of isolated. You know, you're working, you know, independently or with a small team. You get there, you find out, how do I eat? Where's the gym? Where do I get, you know, fresh water, and where's my computer, and you get to work, right? This is very normal. We're kind of used to this. On the folks that haven't done that, I think this is very challenging, and they're learning, and I've done some forums with business folks lately, and I think they're starting to get acclimated to it. But for us, I think it's very common, you know, from kind of a SEER school mentality to, you know, we've done these kind of isolated deployments. But to me, it comes down to two things. Because I'm pretty linear in my thinking, it comes down to fear and hope. So how much we work together is dependent on how fearful I am of self-preservation and for my family, and then how much hope I have left, right? And so, I mean, they say hope is the last thing to die, right? So I think that, but the other thing I'd say is I think this is very different than what we've done in the past. Based on our backgrounds, you know, being out in combat zone or in third world countries working, you have a different approach to things. You oftentimes you gain adrenaline from that. You're very comfortable in that. You, you know, in a firefight situation or a potential kidnapping situation, you switch on and you handle it. It's very different when you're at your house with your family. You know, especially with children, I look at myself as handling this very different than I would if I was, you know, out and about downrange somewhere. So I think there's some big differences there, but I think overall, just the state of, hey, you're isolated, get your computer work, find food and water, I think we're fairly, you know, accustomed to that.
Yeah, great points, Brig.
Yeah, this is Nick. I definitely agree with Brig, and I think that the interesting thing to kind of caveat to what Dan was talking about, every 2 days I have 3 or 4 friends that are civilians, never in the military. They call me up, and they always ask, what's next? What's going on? What do you think? They always ask those million-dollar questions. I think the interesting thing with that is, what are they doing? They're actually leaning on people with experience, leaning on individuals like all of us on this call that have experienced some sort of depth within this realm. And so what we're doing is we're trying to give them the best guidance we can as far as, you know, taking care of your family, security, the what ifs, and trying to really help people analyze the situation without trying to put them into that fear category like Brig was saying. I think when we talk about the fear factor of this, the interesting thing is, if any of us think about the deployments we've been on, the normal versus abnormal that's really prevalent here, because we go overseas for 30 days and about 30 days into it, it becomes normal for us. And so when you spend 6-8 months overseas working on a regular basis and you're coming home for those short intermittent trips, coming back home is actually the abnormal side of it. The stop sign, the following the speed limit, not worrying about a heightened sensitivity of security in every aspect of your day or your life. It's sort of the same thing when it comes to everybody's reaction now. This is becoming the new norm. And as we get into another 15-30 days of this, this is going to become people's normalcy, comfort level. And when all of this shuts down, like you guys are saying, and when we can go back to work, when we can go back to the beach, when we can go experience things such as sporting events and concerts, we're not going to do that right out the gate. People are going to be afraid to buy that ticket. Be afraid to go to that concert because they're so used to the normalcy, which was actually an abnormalcy for us, which is the.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Nick. To me, it's a, it's a train of thought where being exposed to crisis, if you're intelligent enough to absorb a good crisis, brings on that experience and that wisdom. And people see that inherently for people in the military. In a lot of first responders. And I think that's where we as a company now are being looked at for those answers. And I think it's really great that, I mean, I look at this and I'm just looking at the guys that are on this call. And I think about how many deployments we have amongst us, how much actual experience we have, how much crisis management we have. And it's really a pretty phenomenal thing. And to Brig's point, I think we as a country have been living on strategic information. And this crisis has brought it to a tactical level. It's brought it to our front porch. And I think for people that are under 30 years old, this is probably the first time it's happened. And so they are starting to think like a lot of our parents, whether it was after World War II or our grandparents after the Great Depression. And I think a lot of people are going to look at the coronavirus outbreak as a biological Great Depression, because now I think it's going to persist and manifest itself into a completely different train of thought for how people evaluate out of themselves, their personal readiness, their family readiness, but our country readiness. And one big aspect that we've talked about is a due diligence. And I think a lot of corporations and a lot of folks are reshaping their mindset of what that looks like.
Yeah. Let me ask a question, guys, because I this is something that's been on my mind. That's great points, Dan, and great points, everybody. What do you guys think? So in theory, right? How, I mean, okay, so in Michigan right now, Brig, I know you're out in Cali, but in Michigan, Nick, you're in North Carolina, but in Michigan, where you guys aren't, you know, we're dealing with a pretty unique situation here. In fact, I think we should know here in the next 30 to 40 minutes what the governor is going to do as far as the next 30 to, you know, 15 days or so. So what do you guys think as far as the effects of this lockdown supply chain? I mean, what are the biggest concerns? I mean, you're all experts in security. What are the security concerns that you think we face?
I think the biggest thing that we're facing here is the fact of the unknown, which we've been talking about. Let's just say that food doesn't run out off the shelf. Walmart will always have food, Harris Teeters, and so forth. But we as individuals don't know that. People that have not experienced this before. And so the fear factor of them waking up one day and everything that's in their refrigerator is all that they have. How do you fend for yourself and how do you deal with that situation is definitely creating that stress level. And to take that one step further, I wanna really focus on the 70% of the population. The 70% of the population live paycheck to paycheck. Some of them haven't received their stimulus check. Some of them have not received unemployment. So they're sitting there essentially for 4 weeks with no money as of right now. What are they gonna do? And the real question is, we're humanistic. So we essentially are gonna take care of our family and ourselves to the best of our ability until we can't anymore. And we're gonna see that humanistic trait start to creep out for the people that do not have access to funds. And to your guys' point, that's where we really need to help our neighbor. That's where we need to focus on figuring out within our community, who needs that help? How can we help? What can the local government within your city, your county do for those individuals or those groups that don't have money right now that need to get through this lull and bridge that gap financially to where we don't have that civil unrest?
Well, I think it comes down to index cards. I read a pretty good book probably about 5 years ago called With, and it describes the situation with the elderly and the levels of depression, levels of suicide, and things like that. And the question is why? Why do all those rates go up, you know, with elderly? And the author explained that, kind of laid out, if you put about 10 different index cards in front of you, each one has kind of a piece of livelihood. As you kind of grow up, you know, you have friends, you know, you get a job, you have family, children, you know, health, money, and all these things are on individual index cards. And as life goes on, those index cards are taken away. So that at the end of life, you're left with almost no index cards, and maybe your health is your last index card, and that starts going away. And so I think as we look at the security situation, as those index cards go away, you know, maybe there's this, you know, food shortage, you know, maybe there's, you know, we lose someone in our family or a friend, you know, to coronavirus, or we lose our own health or whatever it may be. But as those index cards go away, people are going to revert to fear, right? We've all been fearful. We've all been in that situation. And at that point, we start looking at life through a soda straw, right? We can't, it's, you know, it's just like, you know, in critical incidents, you know, a guy at 7-Eleven pulls a gun on you, you know, generally, you know, you see the barrel of the gun only. You only see directly in front of you. You don't see the bigger picture. You don't see the full battlefield. And so I think as time goes on, and if it does worsen, it becomes more like that. You know, I'll use the example of Somalia, you know, and food shortage, and where do I find, you know, clean water, and then fear dispenses and permeates through society, and then we start a herd mentality and self-preservation. And so I think worst case scenario, that's what happens. And once we get in that mode, then, you know, we start to enter into chaos.
Yeah, that's pretty that's a pretty wild thought process on that, Greg. And you know, now looking back at it, I can totally see how that correlates, you know, throughout the timeline that we call life, you know. And as you were talking about with like the food situation, and as I discussed earlier, how we're seeing that second order effect right now, that third order is what's going to hit us next. So we have this food situation right now in the supply chain. And now it's at this point, farmers are having to drop their crops or their loads or whatever the case may be. okay, are they going to be able to do the next one? They're not making any money. So when does it affect that essential personnel to keep the river flowing, essentially? Because sooner or later, there's going to be a beaver dam. it's gonna hold everything up. And yes, as America, we can feed a lot, but hunger is still the number one disease out there, you know?
Yeah, and I think too, I mean, just to our backgrounds and experience, you know, we know that, you know, we need water within 3 days, we need food within 30 days. So we all say, okay, hey, you know, I can survive for 30 days really without food. But then we, you know, the reality is, you know, we have families, we have kids, wives, you know, we have grandma, right, as Chris mentioned. And so that's a whole different level of substantial fear that can set in, is taken care of, because we are sheepdogs, you know, we're shepherds. And so we have this motivation to take care of grandma, right? And so we're more concerned probably with grandma getting fed than ourselves. And so that's a third order of effect in the kind of relationship level of, you know, protection and self-preservation.
I also think that as we talk about the third order effects, the security aspects are going to really drive additional measures as far as what's going to take place. Let's talk about two examples. The first one is we're talking about transportation and the supply chain. The people that are driving those loads of food across the country are $50,000 to $60,000 employees. And all it takes is one or two of those semi-drivers at a truck stop to be robbed for them to say, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm done. I'm going on unemployment. Who's going to drive that load? No different than the banking systems. Our banking systems are run by $15 to $20 an hour employees. So when there's a bank that's robbed, because right now there's zero civilians other than workers inside an actual bank branch, the drive-thru. So you have no additional security measures other than if they put an unarmed guard in a bank and then the employees in that bank. If somebody robs a bank, employees are going to think twice about going to work. And so here we are, if that happens, now you're stopping the supply chain of funding. And so if we were to see this critical measure take place when it comes to the supply chain of food or the supply chain of funding, that will really create some problems within this. And I think that's where we, as risk managers, we step back and we look at things, we analyze the supply chain, but then we also look at what would shut it down. What would take this current system and put it into a new abnormal state, which would create more stress, strain, and panic within everybody in the communities.
Real quick, shout out to all the people driving trucks right now, doing the job, getting it done, risking their to make sure America's fed. That's insane.
And you know, Chris, if you think about it, think about where the truckers are positioned right now. So let's just say you're running a load from East Coast to West Coast. Right now, they can't stop at any restaurant. They can't stop at any fast food joint because they can't get their semi through the drive-thru and they can't go inside. So they're controlled at truck stops and end destinations and distribution centers where they're picking up and dropping off. That's it. They can't even stop at rest areas. So if you were looking at this from a standpoint of security, they are channelized from start destination, a truck stop, which is pretty predominant with 200, 300, 400 trucks in the parking lot, and an end destination. That's it. So when it comes to security aspects, they don't have a lot of options. And then on top of it, with these corporations, you know, I don't want to name off any of the trucking companies, but they put restrictions on employees that work for those trucking companies where you can't even carry a weapon. So because of insurance purposes. So now you're an unarmed trucker running through Detroit, Michigan in a pandemic state, and you need to get your load there and you're making $50,000 a year. The first time you get robbed or held up to any degree, you're done. You're going to put your, you know, you're going to go back home. You're going to collect unemployment. Somebody else is either A, going to pick up that job, or B, we're going to cut that supply chain down a degree.
Well, we're seeing that now. I mean, even with certain security candidates, it's easier and more convenient for them right now to claim unemployment than to come work, you know, jobs. So, I mean, they're fighting that on the national level. People aren't applying for Department of Homeland Security right now. People aren't joining or able to really even join the Army or the military or whatever the case right now. They're stuck. Everything is at a halt. And, you know, it's how do you affect training without an actual physical attack? Well, it got figured out.
So, I mean, in this discussion, I think when people hear the word security, they think guns and ammo, right? So my question to you guys is, my vignette is, I bought a shotgun, I think a month ago now, and last word I got was that it should be coming in the end of June or July, right? So, and then there's no ammunition in the particular store where I bought the gun, so I have to borrow some buckshot from somebody, but along the lines of the topic of weapons, and Nick's talking about, you know, truck drivers being armed and things like that, are we in a better situation with now everyone buying guns across the country, or are we in a worse situation?
We are in I think it's 400% or something like that, sale ratio compared to where we were. A guy that owns a local gun store near the office here in Milford, here on Valley Guns, great people that own it. Shout out to Ed Swadesh. You know, they did basically in a quarter what they do in a year. that's crazy. And just so everybody's aware, I did pull the box of Black Talons. I have one box of 9mm Black Talon left in my world. Can't find these rounds anywhere. I have one box of it left. So I'm charging $200 a round, anybody's interested. It's crazy. I think this leads us to an undesired risk, which is gun owners are out there, and they're carrying these guns. They're carrying these handguns they're buying. They're probably putting them in their vehicles as well if they are leaving. And a lot of these people aren't trained. I'm one of those pro-gun people that doesn't advocate untrained people having guns. You know, I've carried a gun since I was 18 years old. I've had a gun with me since, you know, I've been an adult. And even when I got my CCW and I was able to carry legally and all that, it's like grabbing my wallet or my phone or my Benchmade pocket knife in the morning. I mean, it's something that I put on every day, but it's also something that I train with quite frequently, whether I'm doing dry fires in my house. I mean, I'm one of those radicals with it, but I think it's crazy. I think more people have guns now. I think more people are untrained with those guns. I think it gives people a sense of security. I mean, I know it gives me a sense of security, right? That I know I have my, 200 guns in my house that I can only shoot, one at a time.
You know, I think it's really interesting, and I'm going to piggyback on a couple of folks here. I think there's a lot of folks in the United States right now who are beginning to realize two things. It's that, like the truck drivers, when crisis happens, we rely on some of the, mostly on the lesser educated, lesser paid to win the war, when it all comes down to it. And the second thing is, it is interesting that I can see why there's a rush on guns after 9/11. Yeah, we actually have a physical terrorist there. And I think it's interesting that it's a rush for guns to defeat a virus. And so people begin to focus on a possible second or third order effect before they focus on the issue at hand. And I think that's a mindset that is created by crisis. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Yeah, can I just add to that, because I don't think it's about – I necessarily don't think it's people want to defeat the crisis. I think there is this unspoken fear of uncertainty with what people are going to do if it gets bad. And I think part of that fear comes from watching, you know, what's that Will Smith movie? Somebody help me out.
I Am Legend.
I Am Legend, right? So right after this whole thing starts, my 9-year-old wants to watch I Am Legend. And I totally forgot what I Am Legend was about. And halfway through the movie, I'm like, this is 3 weeks ago. I'm like, why are we even watching this right now? But, right, I mean, people, you know, he opens his closet in that movie and he's got all these guns. And how many guys with just, you know, a lot of cash to burn in their pocket are like, hey, I want to open that closet and have that many guns. You know, and I think it's this sense of security that people are lacking right now. And that's the reason they're buying these guns, is because they feel like it's going to give them a sense of security. But I also think, to your point, Dan, I think that there is this unspoken feeling of how bad could it get.
I mean, and I 100% agree. I mean, you're seeing people that are usually anti-firearms buying firearms. And that's great to me. I love it. Absolutely love it. I love a little chaos with what's going on. I don't support people carrying firearms that aren't trained, but at the same time, they have a right to and eventually get that training. So they still need to protect those unalienable rights. So that's completely fine with me. And it also helps feed what? The economy, the local economy, the stimulus checks, right? It stimulates the economy regardless. And every time there's an issue, whether it's from big government or from the very bottom, everybody goes buys guns, even the people that usually are anti-gun. It's hilarious. And every time something happens, it's a new record-breaking deal. But us as Americans at the end of the day, and we're talking America here, not Europe and Asia and all the other continents, America, that's our right. And we also need to do it to keep checks and balances, because we see things going on around the community. I mean, you had a lady in, what was it, Idaho the other day get arrested because she was at the park. Who cares? She wasn't hurting anybody. She wasn't breaking any actual laws. She's technically just nudging shoulders with a lawful or maybe unlawful order, just like here in Michigan. You have our governor right now kind of doing what she's doing, and everybody's off about it. You have the UAW completely out of work. That's holding up everything, because this is the world headquarters for Daimler, Chrysler, GM, Ford, and I don't know, there's probably another one out there somewhere. But the trickle chain goes down the line, and that snowball effect starts to tumble. Soon it's going to be hitting all their plants, whether it's in South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky, Mexico, you name it, that all trickles. So it's interesting to me how that always unfolds.
I have a question. I think it's another tangent on this. Is somebody, I guess, at the government level planning for, anticipating for that state that we could reach, food shortage, clean water, chaos, crisis, what that could look like, worst case scenario? Is there an entity that is looking at that and how to management, you know, the Al-Qaeda concept of the management of savagery? At the strategic level, which made AQI formidable in Iraq. Is there someone that's doing that you guys can see, or should we be doing that?
What was the question again? I'm sorry. It was a lot of big words, man.
Go ahead, Nick.
I'm ready to take notes, Brig. Go ahead and ask it again.
No, I'm just saying, like, you know, I feel like we're looking at the hood of our car as opposed to the horizon right now, everybody, and probably even the government. And I don't watch the news except for the BBC, just because I feel I'm very cultured and refined. But don't laugh. But is there someone that's looking, I guess, at the government level, at the strategic level, at how to manage the country if we reach that chaotic state? if we do have food shortages and everyone's armed and untrained, like Steve is talking about, and maybe we're trying to find, you know, clean water, what happens if there's an EMP? You know, all these kind of worst case scenarios, is there an entity that's looking at that and developing, you know, kind of strategized plans to deal with that?
I'd hope so.
Oh yeah. I mean, you had the continuity of government plans. They're all through there. I mean, from the top on down, you know, sustain the government and the political leaders. And then there's the continuity of that after that. If someone gets taken out, there's always these checks and balances. I mean, unless it gets completely out of whack and everybody gets sick or everyone dies or whatever the case may be, then obviously we rebuild from the top. And as Americans, we're going to do such a great job at that anyways.
You know, I think the hard part is this. Within the government, a lot of times we create single points of failure. And that's the hard part about this, because we try to, if we want to call it, run efficiently. The downfall is right now, a lot of people within the government are out of work. They're furloughing people. They're chopping jobs in half. And right now on this topic, we really need increased numbers looking at the intelligence side of this, the what ifs, the tabletop exercises, all of these different aspects of large scale understanding of physical security and cybersecurity within this. I think the hard part for all of us is if we just take a city, let's say Detroit, for instance, everybody's working overtime in the first responder realm. And so here you are, there's no way to scale in Detroit right now because Detroit is already maxed out with what they're doing. Now we add the pandemic in to where you take out 30 officers within the PD because now they're falling under this corona quarantine. So that's 30 people that could be within your mid-level or leadership positions that have the answers and have the understanding and experience. So now we're down to dealing with a lack of personnel on the street or dealing with those type of situations. And when you look at that across the states, and we take every city and they have the same, virtually the same issue that's going on with this response side, they are stuck dealing with the coronavirus situation. And they don't have the ability to deal with the threats that might arise from this. And I understand that Trump put a task force together to deal with these types of situations as far as opening the country, managing the threat level, managing the economy, ensuring people have funding and access to food and just your commodity type items that you need within your family to keep this civil unrest from happening. But the downfall is you can only control it so much at a leadership level. Then it comes down to each state and city managing within their realm. And when we have individuals like what's going on in Lansing, Michigan right now, that throws a wrench in that plan. Because now we have somebody that wants to do something a little bit different than what everybody else is trying to accomplish. And no different than in Virginia, if they want to take your guns away. Well, what does that do? It instills fear. People go out and buy guns, and we raise the number of guns being purchased by 400%. And now we're just creating this trickle effect of change, of just constant change. And while we're trying to create a little bit of normalcy out of this.
To me, it seems like they're still reacting instead of it being a something that came from a plan that they have drawn out years ago and said, hey, we need to prepare for this. Like, I mean, that this is Rob's wheelhouse. I mean, he has a lot of jobs and a lot of meetings and a lot of tentative offers to go through these continuity operations with these municipalities. And they all, it just always seems like they're always like, this guy's handling it over here. We'll deal with it when it comes to it. Well, that's like the worst decision you could ever make, because now you're constantly making knee-jerk reactions with whatever your population is for your area of responsibility, whether it's 500 people or 1.2 million people. It's all knee-jerk reactions. And obviously that's like me going to the grocery store. I can't go to the grocery store when I'm hungry because I'm making knee-jerk reactions on every single thing I see on that shelf instead of having a good list that says, oh, I need this, this, and this. Don't get the Fruit Loops this time, Chris, because you don't need any more Fruit Loops. They're doing the same thing for all these decisions for everyone that they're responsible for. Not in control of, but responsible for.
it's all reactive, right? It's all been reactive. The proactivity, I almost feel like, and I'm gonna, you know, I might catch some flack for saying this, but I almost feel like, you know, we were caught with our pants down right here in this whole thing. And I mean, not just supply chain, but I mean, the preparedness on the first responder level, the preparedness on the emergency medical level, the preparedness of hospitals, national stockpile. And Rob will jump in here in a second because I know he's gonna drop a knowledge bomb on us. But the problem I have is guys like Rob, and there's a thousand Rob out there telling municipalities across the country that, hey, you need to do a tabletop. You need to do an exercise. And again, it comes down to the second and third order effects of not doing that, not being prepared, and what the inevitable outcome of that is, which is chaos. So I just think that, you know, the after action review that comes from this is going to be great, right? I think everybody has to be, we've been saying this for weeks, self-assessing, talking to each other, municipalities, mutual aid, they got to be talking to each other. I mean, if you have two counties that are next to each other and they have three main, you know, level one trauma hospitals that were unprepared for this, they got to be talking county to county because they're probably using out county resources to bring in to support the medical response. So, I mean, it's just like if there's an active shooter and I rely on a mutual aid request from another county or from the feds, hopefully not, we're in a unique position now, right? Because we're trying to manage through a crisis with, you know, doing everything 10 steps behind of where we should be.
Right. And this is something that we talked about yesterday. It's not that this wasn't planned for, because it's been planned for 20 years. You know, 10 years ago, this is all everyone talked about was the pandemic, whether it was H1N1, H5N1, you name it. The problem is with the plans is that you can't validate your plans on a situation of this scope or this scale. So we are seeing a lot of reaction. We are being reactionary against the plan, which is unfortunate. And, you know, you hear the stories about, well, we had all these ventilators, we had all this PPE, and we got rid of it because we didn't need it. And surprise, here comes COVID. So that's been really the biggest challenge, was not being able to validate the plans and really identify on this scale whether or not it was going to work.
Yeah, it was definitely a good test of all those things. But the problem is, I mean, just like a CCTV gets outdated, so do people's plans, you know? And that's one thing. And that's one thing that I think that we've always talked to people when we're trying to give them assessments or tabletop exercises or continuity plans is these things expire. Your population has doubled in the past 10 years. Technology has gotten far more advanced. We don't need to be analog anymore. We can go digital. These things need to be constantly updated. If not, you're just enabling yourself to get caught with your pants down even more.
But what is so that's a great point, Chris. What is the consistency factor there though, right? I mean, because you look at budgeting, and Rob, you could speak to this. Brig, you could speak to this from the federal side. There's a budget, right? And maybe a lot of times what gets said is that's not in our budget. Right? So, I mean, Rob, you hear that a lot. That's not in our budget. This, and this, because this is what county commission or, you know, state bean counters have said we can afford. How do you validate the need when the conversation moves to budget versus risk preparedness?
I've got a thought on that. I mean, Rob's the 100-pound brain on this, but you know, I look at corporate hiring practices. And so what is the cost for a failed employee? $240,000 on average, right? So you can either put some good effort, vetting, discernment into your hiring process, investigation, background checks, and bring that good guy in the door versus the problem child that's going to cost you a couple $100,000 to fix on the backside. So to me, that's part of it.
This is Chris. I see it with a problem with our valuation of society, how we value each person or each item. You look at the hospitals right now, and I'm not going to belittle them. They're doing a phenomenal job with reacting to what's going on, and they're having to make a lot of changes, and they're following guidelines that they're being given to follow. But at the end of the day, an N95 mask costs them, on average, before this pandemic, 30 cents. Give or take, right? Right now, they're mad because people have upped that up to $5, $9, $7 per mask. Well, supply and demand, right? But the hospital, for years, have been charging a $3 bag of saline to a customer for $200, $300. When a doctor prescribes something and gives something to somebody, it's immediately a lot more than if a nurse gives it to somebody, administers, right? It's insane. The guy across the street from me, he's a physician. He tells me about all this stuff. And obviously with social media and everything nowadays, we've been hearing the same stuff. Trust it, take it or leave it. You know, you have to weed that out for yourself, but I have a little experience in the medical industry myself, so I know these things. Well, instead of paying the chief of surgery $12 million a year, every single year for the past 30 years, let's make sure that we distribute this properly so that way we have things set in place for if these issues arise. That's the most irritating thing to me is you have this guy over here making $12 an hour over here and this guy's making $12 million. Who needs $12 million a year to survive?
I do.
Put your hands down. You don't need it. You want it because that means you can have really cool stuff. But in a public service industry, even down to our elected officials, they are public servants that we have elected, and they leave offices millionaires when they went in there thousandaires. That's weird. Absolutely weird. And we can't have that. We have to reevaluate our whole value system.
I think you just Marine Corps'd that word, but that's cool. I liked it.
I know. I have to.
So I think you're right. And the funny thing is, you know, it comes to my mind, right? Because I find myself to be sort of, you know, being an entrepreneur, I'm somewhat of a capitalist, right? And I see the capitalist mentality of the hospitals to make money and build wealth and have these crazy, outrageous fees, but at the same time, those fees are on the backs of, you know, insurance companies, which people pay into. I mean, if you really analyze the system itself, which we could go on for hours about, are we advocating for free healthcare? Are we you could go a million different directions. I think the point, though, to your point, is there is a corruption in a market right now that is being monetized by actors, good, bad, and none the wiser. I mean, there's people that are taking $1 million out of their, you know, their coffers to buy PPE because they can make $2 million. That's good business. I mean, that's, you know, if I can make 50% off, you know, what I'm doing, then hey, that's, show me the deal. I'll do it. But at the end of the day, I think that the problem is there's too many people in the middle of this scalping, like you said. And honestly, Department of Justice is starting to fry those people right now. I mean, there's every day there's case after case after case.
So I have a question then. Do you guys feel that the government should play a role, and to what level? Because I'll give you an example. When it took place, when any hurricane takes place down south, who thrives? Initially, it's security companies, and then after that, it's construction companies. So at what level do we allow the government to step in and drive pricing in a capitalistic state?
I don't know, but you know what? Because I'm I'm on the fence about this stuff too, because I believe in making money where the money's good, but I also want to make sure that people are kind of taken care of a bit, on a basic sense, you know, when I see somebody busting their ass for 55, 60, 80 hours a week, and they're making $12 an hour, that stuff irritates me. Whereas you have some executives or C-level folks that just, they go in the office, they put on their suit and they go to meetings and have nice dinners and stuff. And yes, they're making big business deals, but that's just like who they communicate with. It doesn't resonate with me too well. I always believe in hard work, but that's why I'm a middle-class American. So I understand that. I was always meant to be blue collar, and that's fine. I love it. But I think that Putin did something pretty cool with this. Is they were having problem with people wanting upmark prices so much. And he said, you know, why? Oh, because this is what's going on and this is what's driving the price. He said, they have a license here in Russia. They're like, yeah. He said, well, if they're going to gouge the federal government that much, revoke their license completely. And I was just like, wow, man. But I've also personally seen him come in and hold people accountable for their actions when I was overseas during the ISIS surge. It was amazing. I mean, he just comes in a room and the room is just silent. They can't wait to hear what he's going to say and whose toes he's going to step on next.
Yeah. And I think the reason, and when we get back to this, price gouging, the reason why people are so focused on the masks and the price gouging and the, I believe it's because it's a life-saving item that can in and around the United States. I think that's the only reason why. And I think that's why we haven't had so much limelight on other things where people are, let's call it, we can go all the way back to the Dick Cheney days with KBR and Halliburton over in Iraq. But at the end of the day, we're in a position where a good or a service costs money. And during exigent circumstances, those prices do go up. And I don't think something that is not really talked about is how much is the shipping actually costing companies to get those products to that hospital or to that city or municipality, as far as those like N95 masks. There is a cost there. And right now that cost is very high, because think of all the flights that are not flying right now. I mean, the cargo industry is getting hit just like the personnel industry as far as commercial flights.
You know, Nick, you posed a really deep question there. And not to get real deep in an answer, but I think in the philosophy of a republic, the government or past forms of government for us have tried to take the people's power out of the republic. And whether you subscribe to the reading of Mein Kampf, The Prince, The Philosophy, The Tragic Age of the Greeks, whatever kind of magnum opus you would fall back to for exploitation in crisis, you can only hope that something like this will allow people to realize that they need to stay in a participatory fashion in their own government. If not, we end up like Russia. And I truly hope that it gives a lot of food for thought to folks who want to live free in a free country. And you know, it's interesting because I think a democracy is much like a laissez-faire economy. It's what the market will bear or what the people will bear. And so I think if we start to redefine what that is, and that participation, as you touched on, has to start from the township on up, as opposed to it's a federal government only thing. So I'll be really curious to follow and analyze some of the behavioral aspects and how it aligns with some of these COVID changes. And I know it really doesn't answer your question, but I guess that's kind of where my train of thought goes.
No, you really appreciate it. Thanks. I'm kidding.
I'll just, because we're talking about the federal government and having come from that realm, I think I'll just throw this on the table of how much is human nature going to play into this if the government is going to carry us through this crisis? Because my experience in my sliver of a world in the FBI was that, we saw this with the Andy McCabe's in the last few years. There were, five, I'll call them executive folks on the FBI level that were corrupt. And that corruption comes from a selfish human nature. And I know that those five people, or eight or whatever it was, nobody that I know of would ever go through a door with any of them. But they represent the FBI to the president, to everybody else. And within the FBI, we know that they don't represent the FBI. They're a small percentage in the executive management that are corrupt. But I think in general, in the government, I think there is a decent amount of selfish-minded individuals that we're talking about that are going to care for us if it gets bad. How do you guys feel about that?
I'm up, I guess. I don't trust anybody. I keep my circle small. I trust in myself and my own abilities. I don't rely on the government. I just wait and see what they're going to say, and then I just continue about my day and react accordingly. Or I have gone off my plans of what I've already had up drawn in the past and continue on marching from there. So, it's kind of like you said, there's X amount of people that represent us at the top that you wouldn't want them really working with on a day-to-day basis down here at the bottom. You see the same thing in the military. These people over here are making all the decisions, and they're not getting the guidance of the people actually using the things or doing things on the ground. So there's always like that lack of communication. So no, I don't want somebody representing me or saying what I'm going to be doing at the end of the day. I don't care what their background is at the end of the day. That doesn't matter. They're not in my shoes. They're not in my county. They're not in my city or state. And everyone's situation is different. So to just put a blanket on everybody's wounds that are all different isn't exactly the help.
Yeah.
And I worked for the government, so I understand how they are.
Caveat. I think if we were to just, Greg, just take one piece of that, let's just go back to the conversation on guns. I bet there's a lot of people out there that were anti-gun, or they just really sat on the fence and said, I'll never own one. And guess what? They have one in their house. They're the same people that if somebody was to break in their house before all this, who are they going to do? They're going to call 911. They're going to call somebody with a gun to come help them. And so I think people are starting to realize that there has to be a level of independence, because that 911 call, they're not responding as quickly anymore. They're too busy doing other stuff. That's why you don't see cops pulling people over. The mindset has changed. And so with that, we as individuals, as citizens, we have to change. We have to mold ourselves now to be a little more vigilant, a little more independent, less dependent on the government, even down to local level, less dependent on going to the bank and expecting that I can take $10,000 cash out today, because I probably can't. So there's a lot of things that we have to do differently to make sure that we can still take care of ourselves and our family, because as we all know it, we've all been there. We can't count on anybody but who is in your shoes and the person to the left and right of you at that moment. And that's it.
Yeah, this is Dan. I just want to say I really appreciate you guys all coming on. I thought it was a real good conversation. And I know personally, I appreciate this kind of a military brotherhood and a brain trust that we have. I think there's a lot of folks that don't inherently have a support network like this. But I think one of the changes to kind of piggyback off of Nick is that people will develop them. And I think that's very important.
You've been listening to the North Group Podcast, where security refined by intelligence. If you have questions for us, they can be emailed to info@tngdefense.com or visit our website at www.tngdefense.com. Don't forget to subscribe and stay safe.